Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the 10 Laws Podcast with East Forest. I'm Mr. Forest. This week I have a conversation with Nick Norris. Nick was on the podcast before and we ran into each other recently down in southern Utah. I was just out on a hike and was cruising through town on the way back, and there he was, and we bumped into each other like, oh my God. And we talk about that. So it felt like there was something to connect about. And I was like, man, let's do a pod and dig in and see where it leads. And so really happy to have had this opportunity to chat. I'm just getting back from so much touring. We just did that big LA event with John Hopkins and Superposition, Strange Loops doing the visuals, the Numinous event. It was massive. I mean, there were so many moving parts and people, and it was very long and epic, and I'm glad we got it behind us. It was really fulfilling to do. It was also just interesting. I noticed how different it is, like, doing sort of a ceremony concert structure with these other artists in a bigger format, and there were probably 300 people there, but there were just a lot of energies in the rooms. You know, there was people... There are even some people like having conversations, and then there are other people who are like very deep into their experience. Someone doing acro yoga. There was some people who needed some extra help going through difficult experiences. And for myself as a performer, I noticed it was a little hard to like drop in and like find that flow state because the attention, in a sense, was disparate. It was wonderful. Of course, rose to the moment. We all rose to the occasion. But, you know, we're in this interesting space where... How do we walk each other through these experiences when everyone's having a different kind and some people are pushing the edges of maybe what they're able to experience that I'm not inviting, but you know, it's happening, and I want people to be safe, essentially. Like, I want people to have a positive experience, yet there's only so much that I can do. Yet in a way I'm doing the event, so it's kind of like you're the host of the party in a way, and you're like, this is all new territory for us, right? Like, this is a new type of experience where what I'm trying to say is we're all figuring it out as we go along. And this was totally successful, but it just brings up a lot of these questions for me. It's like, how do we walk this walk together where it's in one way impossible to be completely culpable and cover all of our bases together? All we're doing is sort of creating expectations and boundaries, I hope, that we're both create expectations, but inevitably people are people. It's the public. People show up and do what they do. I hope this isn't too, like, diffuse, what I'm saying. I know I'm kind of dancing around, but anyway, it's just on my mind. It was a powerful experience, and I'm honored that people show up to do these powerful experiences together. It was amazing to see our friend Superposition and see John Hopkins again. It's always a treat. You know, last time I crossed paths with him, I was in London, and we were supposed to get together for the day, and he got COVID, and I was only a few blocks away. I'm like, I'm so close, man. So it was great to see him even just for that evening. And he did this beautiful piano improvisation again at the end of the playback of his album, Music for Psychedelic Therapy. That was just magic. I mean, I could listen to that guy improvise on the piano for hours and hours on end. It's so special, so special. So that was an amazing, amazing experience. Before that, lots of other traveling, as you know, but we're gonna have a few weeks here, and I'm getting into some much needed studio work and outdoors time, getting some things done that need to be done in the studio. And then we're gonna be down in southern Utah working with New Earth for a little private retreat situation, little pro bono thing going on. And we're going to be at Esalen, which is sold out on July 1st through 4th, but we added some dates. Just want to give you a heads up. If you're looking for a retreat experience, we'll be at Esalen in December. I believe it is December 9th through 12th. And so that will be online probably later in the summer. If you want to be the first to know about it, to grab a spot, just go ahead and sign up for the newsletter at eastforest.org. I'll also be in North Carolina with Ram Dass Love, Serve, Remember retreat in North Carolina, August 24th through 28th. I'll be performing there. Radha's going to be teaching yoga there. That, I believe, does have tickets available, and that should be really cool. We'll be up in the mountains having that kind of vibe with a lot of other wonderful teachers and people. And it's a great community in Sangha. It's really just about the vibes. So it's good vibe. We are in London, November 15th currently, and there'll be some other European dates there. And there's a couple other dates that are going to be placed into the calendar here this summer. They'll be announced soon. So follow us on social media, East Forest or East Forest Music, or get on the newsletter, eastforestmusic.org, where you do that. And our Patreon is a great way to learn about all this stuff way before everybody and have early access. And it's also a wonderful way to support this podcast. We call it the Council over on Patreon, where I share demos and things I can't share anywhere else. And we do a monthly Zoom council gathering with a certain tier of everybody on there. So check it out if that's your thing and you would like to support this podcast in any way. It's patreon.com/eastforest. I do want to say a thank you to Debbie, Megan, and Lucy, who recently signed up over at patreon.com/eastforest. So thank you for joining and thank you so much for the support. And lastly, we did some restocking at the merch store of the perfume oils and some other items. So if you're looking for certain things in the store, we've got the piano sheet music there and the thumb drives that have the high resolution Music for Mushrooms and In and Spores album all on one thumb drive. It doesn't fit on anything else because it's such a large file. And of course, Ram Dass, Possible Vinyl, things like that, and some clothing. That's all over at the East Forest store at eastforest.org. Okay, well, let's get into this conversation with Nick Norris. And you know, Nick's a former Navy SEAL, as we spoke about a lot in our previous podcast together, and he's doing some really interesting work with veterans and special forces and former special forces folks, particularly with therapeutic modalities, including psychedelic therapy and helping people heal. So we get into that and see where things are at, the state of the state. Let's do it. This is Nick Norris. Yeah, Matt, it's good to see you. Nick, you're back in California, is it?
I am. I'm back in San Diego.
Oh, so. Cool. Yeah, turn down your volume a little bit more.
Okay. My gain.
I'm looking at the, yeah, turn down the gain.
Gain is going to a 3.
Good. That's perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah, so we ran into each other in the middle of southern Utah, which is unusual. I can't say that happens to me very often.
Me neither. And it's probably the first time. And I've shared that little story with several close friends of mine because I just think it's so odd. But maybe it isn't so odd because I think that people are supposed to come into orbit in your life when they're destined to, I guess. So,
well, even more strange is you and your wife were at the event we played in San Diego, what, like a day or two before?
Yeah, just prior to that trip, we were at...
Which I did not see you there.
I was sitting like directly in front of you, basically.
Uh-huh. Well, regardless, I'm just saying, like, it's not even like we connected.
No.
And then when I did see you and connect with you was, I don't know, 1,000 miles away. Yeah. In southern Utah at a pizza place after I got back from a hike.
Yeah, in the most beautiful area of the country. That southeast part of Utah is just incredible. And we had decided to go out there. My daughter does gymnastics, so we did her tournament up in Salt Lake City, and I convinced my wife and two children to live in a camper van for a week. So
how'd it go?
It was amazing, actually. I think my wife actually loves Utah, and she's been pretty committed to being in California just because it's a beautiful place. And she, at the end of the trip, said she would love to spend more time in Utah because of how beautiful the trip was.
Yeah. Well, that was a good time of year, too. I think I just finished, I went out with my friend Matt Graham, who's been on the podcast a couple times, who's a survivalist and outdoor expert and primitive skills guy. And I love going out with him because I think that time we had dropped into Death Hollow, and he always knows like the sneak routes in, and like it's always a little precarious, but you know, we're foraging plants and fishing and, you know, he'll do like a Bodril fire just for fun. And, and I know like whatever goes down, we're cool.
You're good.
He's going out in a couple weeks on the solstice to go out for until the next equinox, so for 3 months.
Wow. In Southeast Utah.
Southern Utah, yeah. They'll kind of bounce around to different locations based on the what's in season and temperatures.
It's amazing because that area is, I mean, it's austere to say the least. I mean, you do have rivers in that, but I mean, the terrain, it's dry. I mean, it's pretty, I mean, it's formidable terrain. I mean, I pose those questions to my kids and my wife as we were like hiking on that trip. Like, if you were out here by yourself, what would you do? And I think a lot of people are just at a loss for words.
Look for a cell signal. Yeah.
Walk until you get to a road and then try to flag somebody down.
Yeah. People get lost out there. You know, there's always a few people a year they're doing searches for. And the general consensus is, like, if you're lost, like, try to find the flow of direction of water, even if it's like drainages or something, and just keep following that. Yeah. Usually it will eventually lead to a road or civilization at some point.
Yeah.
The water flows where people go.
It makes sense, right? But you can totally tell. I mean, we hiked out to Zebra Slot Canyon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a really well-marked trail and you can get out there. But the second you leave kind of the trailhead, if you weren't on a trail, it would be really hard to figure out where you are and even see where you're like, where you started the hike in from, because the terrain is just this, it's like relentless micro terrain where you get up to a high point and you still can't really see very far because of the way the terrain unfolds.
Yeah. That's a decent hike in too. I think you're walking through a wash for like 6+ miles or something.
Yeah.
So it's a lot for kids to do that one.
Yeah. It was good. So, I mean, all in all, I mean, we got the kids and my wife in a van and we drove down to the 12 through Boulder and then Escalante, just knocking out some hiking as we went. And
nice.
Lo and behold, we stopped in the only place, I think, or one of the few places on that highway you can actually get a meal. And yeah. I think I walked in, we ordered, I sat down in the back little seating area, and I was probably checking my phone because I finally had cell reception, and then just recognized your voice and looked up and you happened to be sitting there with Matt sharing some pizza.
Yeah. Well, here we are from that encounter. And you told me a bit about sort of what you've been up to since we last spoke. What's changed, or what's been deepening with the work with your vet buds in regards to mental health and any intersection there with psychedelic therapy? Is it still ongoing, or is it mostly overseas?
Yes. I mean, still ongoing, still overseas. I mean, or still, you know, in countries where it is either not scheduled or off schedule. So Mexico predominantly for Ibogaine and 5-MeO. And then there's work with psilocybin there as long as it's held in a traditional kind of construct. And then Costa Rica a little bit, but you know, with, you know, COVID shutting a lot of the travel down, that kind of went on pause, and the focus has been in Mexico predominantly.
Yeah. So have you worked with Ibogaine personally?
I did. Yeah. I took Ibogaine just prior to the pandemic kicking off, like March of 2020. It was probably 9 months after my first major psychedelic experience, period. I had kind of paused because I had a very, very productive 5-MeO.
Which you talk about that in the last podcast for sure.
Yeah. Very, very productive, right? Like, integrated my near death experience, really opened my heart and really started connecting me, I guess, reconnecting me to my wife and my children. And I thought I was just fine. I'm like, I'm good. I'm integrating and everything is great. But I had some friends that were really prodding me to consider Ibogaine because it had been very impactful from them. It's just different. You know, it's a little bit more of a grounded experience in your life and, you know, kind of being able to review life decisions and life experiences from a more dissociated standpoint. And I'm blessed that I, you know, I had people poking me a bit to go and have that experience because it was really what I needed. And, typically, you know, guys are going down and doing ibogaine followed by 5-MeO like a day later. So it's like a, in a retreat construct.
Wow.
But, yeah, so it's a lot, but I mean, I did it kind of in isolation. I did 5-MeO by itself, which was great for me. And then when I went, to take ibogaine in Costa Rica, I actually passed on 5-MeO, the day after, because I just, you know, I've been really focusing on listening to my intuition a lot more. And there was just something that felt, it didn't feel right for me to have another experience because I got everything that I needed from that first experience with ibogaine. And I've, and it has proven to be, a good decision, right? Our intuition, more often than not does not lead us astray.
Yeah. That, there's a lot there because even for myself, I think to some of my very first ayahuasca experiences, I've worked with ayahuasca maybe, I don't know, half a dozen times. And even psilocybin, like I'm still processing and feel very salient with a lot of those early experiences that I had. And that they're just reverberating so loudly in my life that, yeah, there's a part of me that wants to be there again in a sense. But there's also a part of me that's like, doesn't want to feel greedy because... Well, you know, on one hand, you know, it never repeats, you know, whatever you have one experience and then you have another completely different, fantastical, whatever difficult experience, it is what it is. So there's also, you know, that down inside, you're like, well, it's always like an opening of this gateway to the numinous and you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
but I do though feel like to really receive some of those feelings that when they're that alive for you, it's sort of like, why do you need to double it in a sense? Or why do you need to, it's just there. I don't know. Right. It's in some ways timeless.
Well, we live in a society where like more is always better, right? We overdo things. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Like, you know, taking what I need from an experience and kind of when I get some phenomenal insight, really sitting with that and focusing on kind of the integrative process has been the biggest change. You know, back to your original question about like what's been going on, you know, we're still, you know, the nonprofit that I spend time with is still doing work and getting guys and gals an opportunity to have that peak experience. But on a personal front, you know, I've really, really settled into integration and kind of finding my own spiritual practices on a daily basis. And that has all come from that catalytic experience with both 5-MeO and ibogaine. I'm trying to just sit with it more and really soak it in as much as I possibly can.
I mean, what else is there to do? But in a lot of ways, it's always like we're trying to find the next thing to do. And a lot of it is being.
Totally.
It's like taking the curriculum in a sense. It's like going to school as opposed to like, well, today I'm taking a vacation or I'm,
right.
I'm, you know.
I have a good friend of mine actually framed it as, you know, these peak experiences with plant medicine, you know, psychedelic medicine are, it's like renting a house, right? Instead of owning the house. So you get to rent an awakening for a short window of time, and then you have to give it back unless you decide that you want to actually go all in and start making that mortgage payment every single month with the hope that in 30 years you'll own it. You know, the bank won't own it anymore. You'll actually own it. And I love that. I love that analogy because I am a huge proponent, obviously, of the healing that can be opened up within us through these medicines, but I'm an even bigger fan, and I'm like a novice now of applying spiritual practice every single day into my life to really own my awakening and find that connection, you know, with God, you know, oneness, love, whatever you want to call it. But it's putting the work in. It's simple, not easy, right?
Well, the more you quote unquote, do that work, I think the less it's work, it's more like, what else is there to do. I mean, in some ways, you're always just looking to deepen your experience because there's always a sensation in the background of almost like this, like a perceived separation.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, you're wanting to ameliorate that because that's a natural feeling. It's like, I just want to be closer to the thing I know I am.
Yeah.
How do I do that? Is it through this? Can I have a beer or should I, maybe it's about going on a run or maybe it's going to be about, you know, everything we do in a sense.
Yeah.
Is chasing that dream of truth, whether we're conscious of it or not. Do you find like with the guys and gals you're working with through the vets and in this work, beyond that peak experience, like how are they navigating like after it or what kind of successes or challenges are you facing through that work?
Yeah, I mean, like anyone that is kind of going through hardship and kind of has this aha moment, there's always the kind of honeymoon period where everything is great, right? It's easy. You're on easy street because
you get the tattoo that's like of the fungi coming up.
Yeah. right. Yeah.
The ayahuasca tattoo.
Life is good. Like you love everybody. You're calling all your friends that you had a falling out with and making amends.
Yeah.
But you know, 3 months later, 6 months later, you know, things get tough, right? If you don't put yourself back in a positive setting, you're not surrounding yourself with positive people. You're not, you know, doing the daily discipline practices. You know, people struggle. And I think the biggest help and the thing that has been kind of the glue that holds people together is that sense of community and connection that has been built through these shared experiences. So it's like the medicine just keeps getting served up when you can connect with people that have had that experience and are on this path together to support each other. So I've seen kind of community and connection, you know, loving connection, be one of the most impactful ways that you know, guys and gals have been able to stay on that path and continue to progress.
But is there shame there, like inside the culture? Like, is there a shell that has to be cracked for people to really accept that or open up to it? Or is that like a challenge in itself?
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, coming from, I mean, I'll speak to the SEAL community. Absolutely. Right. Vulnerability is not something that, is the first attribute that you think of when you think of like a hardened Navy SEAL. You know, you think of people that are, you know, callous and cold and capable, but vulnerability isn't the top thing that would pop to mind. But you know what I've witnessed vulnerability manifesting within our community because of the way that, you know, people that have been able to touch it are willing to share and be vulnerable, right? Like vulnerability begets vulnerability. And I experienced it. I mean, I was brought into this kind of path and given the opportunity to, you know, have one of these peak experiences because friends of mine that I would have never guessed would be vulnerable showed vulnerability and shared their own personal struggles and their own healing that they found through this experience. And for me, it kind of cleared me hot, right? It opened the pathway for me to feel comfortable going down this path because somebody that I love and respect and care about from the community is willing to open up and share that story with me. And, you know, I all I can do, and I will tell you, I'll lead with this. I've always known who Ram Dass was. I had friends of mine, you know, frankly, there's actually a good friend of mine from the SEAL teams that mentioned him and kind of the wonderful things that he brought to the world several years ago. And I kind of just like cataloged it and said, okay, yeah, that sounds good. I know I've heard that, you know, great things came from everything he brought to the table, but I have fully immersed. I mean, I feel like I've been,
you went down the Ram Dass rabbit hole.
I've been given a gift. I mean, I think I've read and listened to everything that he has put out, or if I haven't, I'm listening to it now. And, the thing that really stuck for me, and I share this with a lot of friends, is all I can do for you is work on myself, and all you can do for me is work on yourself, right? Be living examples of how we would like other people to be. Don't force it upon them because, you know, I went down that path with friends of mine where I became the evangelical, spiritual awakening guy, you know.
Nobody likes that guy.
No, yeah. No one does, right? They feel, they go on the defensive, right? Like, what's wrong with me? Why are you saying that I have a problem? Am I broken? You know, how are you, you know, what right do you have to point the finger at me? Whereas it really was coming from a place of love. And until I'm embodying that and showing them, hey, this is, I mean, living a life where I'm showing them how loving and connected and happy I am, they see that. And I've had friends see that and say, hey, Nick, I'd like to explore, you know, that thing, you know, with that group that, you know, helped you out so much. And, you know, they come back after the retreat and they're like, I can't believe I didn't listen to the stuff that you were putting out.
And in some ways, that's the only way. I mean, Terrence McKenna used to say that, like, the best endorsement you can give to the medicines as therapeutic tools is just like, live your life in such an exemplary way that people are curious, like, what's working for you?
Totally.
It's not about anything like you proselytize or say. And at the same time, like, as you were saying, like, telling stories and telling your own personal story and one of like vulnerability of your own hardships and what you overcome and how, not only is that therapeutic to tell, but it sounds like it's a kind of invitation for others to say, like, well, I mean, that sounds like that's actually was your initial doorway, you know, it's almost like a baton we pass or like an invitation letter to people. And then it encourages them to see themselves in your own story.
Oh, right? Totally. I mean, I was just at an event this past weekend for our company, and it was an event that is, it was all alphas, right? It was a big fitness event, Sorenex Summer Strong. So they do, it's like all the strength and conditioning coaches in college football and a lot of professional teams, and everybody's big and strong and and very dominant. And I found myself, I found not only me, but I've heard other people at that event sharing messages of love and connection and community. And it was so, it was heartwarming for me because that's where I'm living right now. So I was like lit up and smiling. And I actually shared, you know, I shared personal stories and gave out a lot of hugs to guys that, you know, a few years ago, I would have never imagined, you know, this, a strength and conditioning coach for a, you know, a college sports program, you know, would walk up to me and give me a hug after, you know, he heard me speak about connection and the importance of community. So I see it spreading, and it spreads because people are willing to be vulnerable and share that, you know, kind of that personal story and exemplify it in the way that they live their life. So it's yeah. Definitely out there. You just got to be willing to put yourself out there a little bit.
Do y'all have any plans to like do any of this work more publicly in places like Oregon as psilocybin comes online? Or is it because you're prioritizing Ibogaine or 5-MeO that you have any like domestic plans?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, Ibogaine and 5-MeO, I mean, it's going to take some time. You know, you have MDMA, ketamine's already medically legal. You know, MDMA is next on the docket that will become legal, and then psilocybin on the heels of that. But to answer your question, yeah, there's a big focus on political advocacy within vets. I mean, I'd say political advocacy is one of the primary focuses of the organization. So there's been, I mean, there was actually a SEAL, former SEAL, that was one of the, I think he was one of the juggernauts in Oregon to get that legislation passed. So it's funny because he was the guy that no one in the world would guess would be involved in any of this work or be vulnerable or spreading a message of love and acceptance. And he turned out to be kind of one of the primary movers for Oregon, getting to that point. So a lot of political advocacy. I know we as vets, as an organization, is a co-sponsor of the California decrim legislation that's, you know, in action, still waiting to take hold. There's been work in Texas. You know, you think of Texas as a pretty conservative state, but this stuff is bridging political boundaries like I've never seen. And Texas is now, I think they have a legislation that has been passed where Texas money will be funding VA studies with MDMA, ketamine, and psilocybin for veterans. And the list goes on and on. I mean, there's a lot of kind of grassroots effort to get this stuff out there, because, you know, VETS is focused on the special operations community and combat veterans, but that is a very small segment of who will benefit from this. I mean, you and I both know that this work is beneficial to all of humanity. And the biggest thing that we can do as an organization and as a community of former special operations is to be a voice and a bridge, you know, to try to kind of close the divide between the right and the left and get us unified on this, right? I mean, this is apolitical. This is about helping humanity have an opportunity to open themselves up to healing and find that, you know, that peace and happiness that, you know, I feel like we're being gifted through this work.
There's not much. I mean, there's not much that crosses any political divide. I mean, the only thing happening right now that there's a little bit of consensus on is about Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But you would think that when it comes to just cognitive liberty,
yeah,
that the right would be into that.
Right.
And the left would probably want to traditionally regulate it, but they'd be into the mental health aspect. So maybe they have different reasons that they're on board with it. Or, you know, we want the tax dollars or that kind of drug policy that isn't working. But it does seem to be more about mental health.
Yeah.
And it also could be a symptom of the fact that we're really spiraling as a people who need there's a lot of problems with mental health. I think there's a pretty fair recognition of that. So it's just kind of like, man, what do we do? What tools do we have beyond what we've been using thus far? And I hope that we can lean into that, because I suppose one of the advantages with psychedelic therapy is that it can be quite strong and sometimes have a large impact faster, perhaps. And I only think that's relevant only because time is a bit of the essence as far as creating changes on a personal level, or just finding ways to deal with collapse on a personal level. It's like that isn't destructive to yourself or others around you.
Well, we live in a world, I mean, let's face it, like we have become more distracted as a people as, you know, time has marched forward, and, you know, people are looking for kind of that immediate impact, and not saying that psychedelic therapy is the magic pill, because I know that it's, I mean, as we were just discussing, it's all about how you incorporate those lessons on a daily basis after it, but it is powerful. You know, it's catalytic, to the degree that it's been able to open up the calloused hearts of a bunch of hardcore special operations veterans and open up them up to the idea of kind of inner divinity and healing and love, you know, all these buzzwords that aren't buzzwords once you've had the experience, right? It's a sense of knowing.
How are special ops people, are they coming to see or deal with the full picture of their previous actions? Or in a sense, like, I didn't take a full picture, because you almost can't in a way. Like, how can you fully understand some of the things you're asked to do or being a part of a machine that maybe now that you have a more holistic picture on like the universe itself, you're like, I don't think I'd do that now. Or is that not true?
It's, you know what I think is, I mean, from my observation, what I've seen is that, you know, we are all shaped, I think we are mostly shaped by our early childhood, right? Those formidable years in our life, let's call it, I mean, again, people will probably correct me on this, but I'd say between the age of, you know, from birth to 5 years old, you know, our brain is this malleable piece of clay. And the things that we experienced in that early childhood period, you know, kind of create who we are going to be and how we are going to carry on in this world. And I think the number one thing that you know, my friends address is kind of early childhood impactful experiences both positive and negative, you know, through kind of Ibogaine and 5-MeO through this retreat. And I'd say more often than not, it isn't even experiences in combat that come up. It's, you know, guys reconciling with the fact that they were abused physically and mentally, maybe as kids, which led them to compartmentalize effectively at a young age, right? As a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, you know, if they were abused sexually, physically, emotionally, they learned how to lock that stuff down and be very good at dealing with stress and performing and carrying on life with a tremendous amount of stress and baggage. And I think ultimately that's what led them down the path to special operations and to being part of that community, because they were looking for fraternity, brotherhood, community, connection, and they were very capable of dealing with the stressors that come along with a combat, you know, zone and going into combat. Because I mean, I can tell you from my personal experience, you know, when I took Ibogaine, you know, I assumed that I was going to, you know, relive combat, things that happened to me, you know, things that I saw, and I witnessed none of that. And Ibogaine is like, you don't get to dictate what Ibogaine is going to show you. Like, you don't get to dictate what any of these medicines are going to open up in you. But the things that I touched on were like the loving relationships in my life, those that I lost, fractured relationships between me and my mom, my brother, you know, losses that I've had, you know, my younger brother, my dad, and really identifying those areas in my life that led me down this path to where I am. You know, I was struggling. I was cold. I was apathetic. And I was very closed off from people.
Traumas, for sure. But speaking to like early childhood stuff, I mean, it goes back to thinking about like just the power of supporting people to be better parents. So like early childhood education, childcare. I mean, this is super liberal ideas, but it's kind of true in a sense. Like if you really think about how do we support young children and young families and parents, how that the trickle down effect generationally that can have on society is profound. But we don't usually think about like, well, if you pay for that stuff now, how that might help us in 20, 30, 40 years.
I'm a firm believer in intergenerational trauma, right? And trauma carried down through a lineage. I mean, it's
we're focusing on the symptoms in a way. Like we have to treat, because you do want to treat the symptoms, but it's like a lot of these causes go back to like, well, when we're starting life out, if people, you know, it's hard for people who are, everything's a struggle and there's no resources, there's no healthcare and the food's crap and you can't get a good job and then someone goes to jail and this and that. And like, what are we expecting? You know, how's that going to pan out? Or the people who are abused and there's no resources to try to work through and work with that trauma in their own life to integrate it into a new shape. It just gets passed on in a sense or transmutated into some other negative behavior.
Right. And people, I mean, hey, I probably fell into this category of like, that's crazy. It sounds woo-woo, you know, mystical, magical, but it's real. You know, you feel that. I mean, like the abuse that your grandparents suffered was passed on to your parents and it formed them into the person they became. And maybe that's the reason they abused one of their children. And ultimately, if you don't break that cycle and you don't get in the way of that to enact change, you know, why would it ever change? You know, we're conditioned by our environment, and specifically we are conditioned by the people that brought us into this world and that we spend all of our time with during those formative years. So yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that's one of the biggest, you know, blessings having gone through this is really opening my eyes up to being fully focused and engaged with my children and giving them everything I have, knowing that it's going to determine whether or not they carry on a positive kind of lineage or a negative one.
Yeah. Well, you have a few kids. I got to meet them there at the pizza parlor.
I think they were showing off their primitive flint knives.
You got them some flint knives. They were actually quite sharp. Be careful with those.
Yeah, I was using them to like cut boxes down at my house like the next week instead of a steak knife.
It's amazing. Use a primitive tool to open Amazon boxes.
Right.
Well, that's the magic of being incarnate, because when you say intergenerational, there's also the sensation that while you're alive is when you can do this kind of work, and the reverberations it can have into past history and into future history. And it's a much more metaphysical idea. But this feeling I have, like, that's kind of why additionally it's so sacred to be alive, because this is the time when you can heal those wounds and you can do the work, and it has that sort of reverberative effect forwards and backwards.
Yep, totally agree.
And yeah. I worry about things like the traumas we continue. It's sort of like a built-up cause and effect, but the way we start to continue to cascade with more cause and then more effect. And you think about just like the mass shooting that just happened, or even the war in Ukraine. That's a big one where, you know, millions of people, whatever people's, you know, whatever bullshit justifications are going on for some kind of war, it's still like you're basically going in there and just ruining lives and communities and causing untold amounts of trauma on children, on adults, all the generations. And it's like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's so damaging, like the kind of effects that will have. And that's been happening, sadly, for all of human history, but that's in some ways we're continuing to see the effects of that.
Yeah, it's on repeat, right? I mean, regardless of how civilized we get, you know, it's the same thing that's been happening for eons, you know? And it's not like this is the first time atrocities and violence and war and all the other stuff has been going on. And we forget, right? And it takes people to be a strong voice to enact that change and serve as an example to other people. And that's where I'm trying to do. I know that a lot of my friends that have been touched are just trying to live that example, right? Be an example of love and forgiveness and compassion and empathy, because all I can do is do my part. Right.
Well, what would you do, man? Could you serve up again? Like, let's say you were living in Ukraine. Would you join the resistance force now in your state of mind? Or would you say, I can't do that and be in full right livelihood with who I am as a person?
I mean, if I was in that, and granted, I am not in that scenario, but if I was in that situation, you know, I would do what I needed to do to be able to protect the innocent and those that couldn't protect themselves. And, you know, if that involved me participating in combat again, and I'll tell you, I mean, it segues back to why I participated in combat as a SEAL. I truly was doing right to protect people that were having atrocities committed against them. And, you know, sometimes that takes rough people and violence, but it would not be violence for the sake of violence or for the sake of greed or power or manipulation, you know, to protect a child or a woman or another man that's unable to protect themselves. You know, I would step up in that scenario over and over again, not for the love of violence, because I don't love violence. You know, I'm the person that actually tells my kids, don't kill that bug, take it and put it over in the plants. It didn't do anything to you. But violence for the sake of human attachment to things that truly don't matter, is terrible. But to protect somebody that is incapable of protecting themselves and being taken advantage of,
In those acute situations, that makes sense, where there's a right and a wrong that you see in front of you, but you're attached inside a system, whereas like a Russian soldier is attached to this Russian army that has other levels of decision-making, or the American military. Yeah, you might be in a situation where, like, I want to stop that from happening right now, but you're a tentacle, you know, you're suited up with an M16 and connected to, you know, a colonial lineage in a sense. So it's not as black and white, unfortunately. Right. That's why I think it's a difficult decision.
Well, not black and white, but I will say this, because I've had the same question posed, you know, for my personal time in service, and regardless of the fact that I served in the United States military, and you know, I was deployed under orders to be in a specific theater of combat operations, I never would execute on something that I felt personally ran counter to my morals, my principles. You know, going into a village and executing an operation, you can do that with love and compassion and kindness. You can protect people and care for them within the construct of a much larger system or organization, but be willing to stand up against that system when things are not right. You're asked to do something that you feel strongly is wrong, and there is right and wrong, right? I mean, there is black and white. There's a lot of talk of gray in combat, but I am a firm believer that, yeah, though it may appear gray, there is definitely a black and a white as it comes to kind of our behavior as a human being and towards another human being. And what it takes is it takes strong people that are willing to put themselves on the line and stand up against, you know, a system, not be a minion, you know, a devoted minion to a system blindly, you know, executing, you know, some will or desire that isn't true to what is right.
Well, but then you could say, like, the Russian soldier shouldn't be going to Ukraine in the first place because they don't believe in the tenet of going, or someone shouldn't go to Iraq because they're like, I don't believe we should be fighting this mission, as opposed to, like, you know, just zooming out. I'm not saying many of those Russian soldiers who are 18 years old had many options,
right.
but nonetheless, if you just want to talk about it, like, philosophically, I just wonder, like the more I zoom out on certain things in life, with moral or ethical things, I end up usually from this kind of soul point of view. And when I get up into that zone of witness, usually things are kind of clear cut. It's like, look, I just know what is sort of the right thing here, and know what just is not in alignment. And yes, you know, beyond immediate threats and trying to defend yourself, that of course is almost a natural phenomenon, but there is a lot of premeditation involved that's mixed up in a lot of power structures otherwise, that it's kind of hard, difficult to justify. And I'm not trying to, like, specifically speak about, like, even like with Ukraine, it's an interesting metaphor to think about, like, what would you do? Because you see these pictures of people who are like bakers or lawyers, or it's like, and now they're like, have barely any training, and they're like, I'll be part of it, I'll fight back. And I wondered, like, what would I do? Regardless of what I want to do, like, what would I do? And
yeah,
we start to face these sorts of ideas after going through things like COVID, where we, or if you've been in combat such as yourself, it's like sometimes we, as humans, we start to find those edges, like, oh, I've had experiences now where, like, things got really real. And even though we're talking about what happens in America, if we had to have similar decision, we're like, oh, that'd never happen. It's like, nowadays, I'm like, who knows?
It, you know, could.
I mean, anything could happen now. It's like crazy. So,
well, I think it comes down, I mean, Krishna, it comes down to, you know, in the moments where we are not thrust into those scenarios, you know, the periods of time between war and conflict and atrocity, you know, the work that we can do and the change that we can enact is having an impact on the way we are governed, the political systems, like career politicians that are in office solely for their own personal glory, or to serve some corporation that is hell-bent on profit over everything else. You know, you may not have the choice if you are thrust into that scenario, because self-preservation will kick in, and love for your, you know, your neighbor or your wife or your children starts to surmount any, you know, any more grand kind of philosophy or insight regarding the world. And you know, I think it's a wake up call for us to say, hey, when we have the opportunity, we should really look at the why and the who that is guiding our population, right? I mean, you know, we need to make change on that front if we're going to ever make change across the world.
Well, you said you have a lot of focus on political activism through your organization. I mean, what does that lobbying look like? Are you finding much success, or is there sort of like behind the scene talk, but then there's like, well, look, here's our public position. This is what we can get done. What's the lay of the land?
It's been actually inspiring. I will tell you, the last gala that Vets, the first gala that Vets put on last year, we had a stage that was shared by Rick Perry, former governor of Texas.
The oops guy, yeah. He said oops in the presidential debates, and then that was it for him.
Right. So you have Rick, Perry, kind of like the poster boy for conservatism, right? Coming out of Texas. Rick Doblin from MAPS, who's probably the poster boy for kind of the left and kind of liberal beliefs. And it was moderated by Tim Ferriss.
Nice.
And they were all three of them were sharing a stage to talk about how psychedelic assisted therapy and psychedelic medicine is a powerful tool to kind of cross those political boundaries for the sake of healing and helping and really trying to fix kind of a broken political system and society, you know, that has been, I mean, frankly, I mean, hell bent on, you know, profit, right? I mean, the reason our country, I think, has suffered so much, you know, from like a mental health standpoint, is that we've been Band-Aid fixing things. We've been putting people on antidepressants, opiates, sleep aids, and not really digging down to the root cause. I mean, some of these things have just perpetuated the problems, you know? They've become, you know, opiate abuse in this country dominates, you know, kind of addictive patterns. You know, people look at, you know, kind of heroin and methamphetamine and cocaine as the big problems. And yes, they are a problem, but, you know, prescription pain meds. I mean, I've seen that in my own family lineage as something that's super devastating. And the prescription drugs that I've had family members prescribe to, you know, quote unquote, help them or fix them have only led to further addiction. So, I think there is people are waking up, right? It's the cat's out of the bag. You know, this stuff isn't a fly by night kind of fad that's going to go away. It's something that can truly enact change. And, so the political advocacy front, it's been really, really interesting, to see, you know, how receptive both the right and the left are, when you pitch this. You know, it is truly something, you know, on both a state and federal level that has been embraced by both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah. Steve Urquhart, who is on the podcast, who used to be a Republican state legislator in Utah, he's now founded a mushroom church there.
Really?
That's very public. Yeah. It's one of the first of its kind. It's been going for several years, and he had a complete shift. And because he knows all those people, like the judges and the police officers, he just tells them, like, this, I mean, he's like, we're at church. This is what we're doing. Please do not come in uninvited while we're doing our sacrament and we're doing our worship.
Right.
That would be very damaging, but here's everything going on, you know? And they've been operating, doing their thing. And Rick Perry, I had heard about actually that. I read an article about, maybe it was the thing that you guys did, but I'm trying to remember what his story was. But he had some sort of personal connection or something.
He did, yeah. You know, Rick Perry, I think it's pretty much, it's public knowledge, but I mean, he had a close personal relationship with several SEALs that I believe were involved in kind of his personal security team.
Okay.
That had actually gone to Mexico and sat with Ibo Game and 5-MeO, and he saw firsthand kind of the impact that it had on them.
Unbelievable.
And then he referred it out to several other SEALs that are close to him.
That's how it happens, right? I mean, that's why I think it just starts to become through someone you know. And it becomes very like grounded, and like it's not a concept. It's just like you said, someone's life is improving, and someone's like, how did it work for you? And that's how the brush fire spreads.
Well, we all have parents. Most of us, we have siblings or friends or children that at some point will be impacted by mental health. Unless you were born in this flesh as an enlightened being, I don't think that you are going to circumvent that opportunity to experience some type of struggle mentally. And because that is so universal in that it touches all of us, everybody has a personal connection to wanting to solve those problems. And I've seen that. I've had people from all walks of life, rich, poor, Republican, Democrat. It doesn't matter. I've talked to people that have dealt with, children, parents, siblings that have struggled with mental health, and some of them, or a lot of them, have turned to addiction, as a numbing mechanism, substance abuse as a numbing mechanism, or Western prescriptions as a way to numb them from the pain that they're feeling.
It's just having support out there. I mean, it's not that there's one tool that's going to work. This is, it's just kind of like, let's use what we have and also make it a kind of story where it's normalized in a sense that people who are sort of hardened or didn't have these sorts of aspects to get into these spaces, there's just more access and opportunity and speaking different, the languages of where people are, what they speak in a sense.
Yeah.
So I'm glad, man. It's good to get that update and hear what's going on for y'all. And I'm glad that that work continues, and I hope it can blossom further in a more open way as things start to open up.
Yeah, well, no, I appreciate it. I mean, it's getting out there and talking about it, right? I think 3-4 years ago, everybody involved was pretty gun-shy about being public with it because of the stigma associated. But now it's like, everybody is okay. I mean, it's like kind of the cool thing, right? I saw there was a New York Times article that launched a couple of days ago about actually a group that has done a ton of work with veterans that is in Mexico, and they were highlighting them treating women, female service members, and women who have lost spouses in combat, so Gold Star spouses, and how they are working with psilocybin and 5-MeO as an opportunity to help heal them. And
nice.
Is in the New York Times, right? It's great, right? So I feel blessed to be involved with it, and we'll just continue the fight to kind of win people over regardless of where you sit.
Well, like you said, not that it's like a catch-all for everything or that there isn't issues or problems with it. I'm just glad that it's just an opportunity for some people. It might be helpful, and particularly for people who have gone through combat experiences, have unique things that they need to work with and heal, and then everybody else who maybe has been the result of that and all the other traumas that we're going through and challenges. So I'm glad you guys are covering at least one angle of it.
Yeah, well, at least being a voice, right? I mean, for
telling
some
the stories, yeah,
yeah. Whether you like it or not, a lot of guys that were in the special operations community, have a fair amount of respect in society, kind of apolitical respect in that, put their hand up and did something that was difficult and gave up a lot of their freedoms for a period of time. And, now instead of just kind of taking that status and using it for personal gain, being a voice to help unite the country politically, on a topic that, frankly is universal and can help everybody. Cause that's the goal, is to make sure that these modalities and medicines are available to everyone. They should be part of our healthcare system. If you're going in and you're struggling with suicidal ideations or addiction, you should be given the opportunity, to start to heal yourself. So, it's not fair that it's relegated to just those that can afford to go out of the country.
Absolutely. Well, what's the way people can find out more or connect?
Yeah, so vetsolutions.org is the website for Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions, started by Marcus and Amber Capone. Marcus was a former development group SEAL. I served with him for a little while before I got out at our basic training command. And, you know, his story's out there. It's public. You know, he was at the end of his rope, you know, had contemplated suicide and had struggled pretty deeply. And, you know, Ibogaine and 5-MeO was the thing that kind of opened up his heart and allowed him to kind of start healing. Anyway, I could tell you, he is a different person. You know, people that knew him from his former life would tell you that immediately. I mean, he is one of the most loving, caring, compassionate people that I know. And they've dedicated their life right now to kind of being an advocate for this, for everybody.
He'd give you a hug?
He would give me a big hug. and he would give you a big hug if you saw him too. But he's wonderful. I mean, he's, you know, yeah, committed to kind of all the things that we said are important, right? The spiritual practices that you're doing daily, like, you know, Marcus embodies that. So, he's a living example of kind of the great work that comes out of the organization. And, it's just going to continue to grow, hopefully.
Cool, man. Well, it was fun to run into you in the desert, and great to see you now. I'm glad this gave us an opportunity to catch up.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I'm not going anywhere. I'll probably, anytime you're in San Diego or Southern California, I'm going to make an effort to be there to support you, because I reached out to you initially, Krishna, because of the music that you produce that is, frankly, beautiful and uplifting. And it was a critical part of my whole experience. And I can tell you, there's a lot of veterans out there that are very familiar with East Forest now. And you hold a special place in all of our hearts. And probably
I really can't wait to play a forward operating bass and do a ceremony concert. Like,
oh, you know, dude.
I would love to do like, what are they called? Tours?
USO tour.
USO tour. Yeah. That would be awesome. I would do that in a heartbeat.
I think it'd be awesome, man. I mean, this is, you know, your music is so impactful, not just for a psychedelic experience, but I mean, music as a whole. I mean,
we don't even have to talk about psychedelics. When I'm at the ceremony concerts, actually, I'm not talking about them. It's more about the thing we're trying to get to, which is about, hey, like, what does it mean to listen? What does it mean to just sit for a second, take a break? If you create some space, what do you hear? You know, what do you want to do?
Yeah, no, I think it's awesome, man. It's all about, I have a very good friend that I've reconnected with recently. He allowed me to read a draft book, draft version of a book that he is releasing soon called The Power of Unwavering Focus by a friend named Don Dapani, who was a Hindu monk, lived in a monastery for 10 years, but left the monastery, and he's a Hindu priest now, has a wife and a daughter. And, you know, he basically shares, you know, kind of the tools that he learned living in that monastery. And the book is tremendous, but it really has kind of, it showed me that meditation isn't just somebody sitting, you know, cross-legged on a pillow in kind of the one seat with their eyes closed and, you know, incense burning. It can be that, and it is that for a lot of people that have embraced that part of themselves, but it's all about unwavering focus in your daily life, right? You know, giving people your full attention and practicing focus as opposed to distraction, because we practice distraction all day long, and we expect ourselves to be able to jump in and focus, which is an impossible task. So I think music, for me, has helped me to really kind of focus. And I think that's why it touched me so much.
Unwavering receiving of the great Bhav, the great love. Well, we'll end it on that note, my friend. It was good to talk to you.
Yeah, and, likewise, brother.
Look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, anytime, my friend.
Thank you, Nick, for coming on the show. Always good to hear from you. And I'm glad that the work is progressing. I'll catch you another time at a desert crossroad. This music that you're hearing in the background is called Dust Fallen, and it is from the Still Possible album that is continuing to release weekly, a track by track. The full album comes out, I believe, June 17th. We have a music video coming out, I think, June 7th. And this track that you're hearing is actually the instrumental version, the solo piano version, which isn't going to be released. The full version has some beautiful strings. That track is out, Dust Fallen, and it's wherever you listen to music. It's currently just a digital release, and it's going to be a full LP. It's all B-sides from the Possible Sessions. So that's what. Thanks again to our friends, patreon.com/eastforest, the council supporters. Check it out if that's for you. I hope to see you on the road. Thanks for getting advanced tickets, and I appreciate you listening, reviewing the podcast, and all that jazz. Keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit, my friends. But if you do, just do it with grace.